You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 439 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from separate locations today. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
I don't know if the Seattle Storm are the only team, professional sports team, to officially endorse a candidate in the presidential election. It certainly was a relatively rare distinction for the Storm. And
I'm having a hard time not laughing at the serious Kevin voice.
I told you, as I mentioned on the Discord, that I went back and listened to the start of the 2016 episode after that election. And I was kind of surprised how not somber the tone was in hindsight. I don't know. I feel like it's tough for me to care about sports that much right now. We'll see. Like, everyone's reaction is valid. Some people want the distraction, and we're happy to provide that for those who want that. But it also, like, you know, a basketball game seems pretty trivial about right now. And I hope people kind of take that to heart.
I think that's totally fair. But there is, I don't want to, you know, have any sort of judgment for how people respond to a situation emotionally. And, you know, caring about sports this weekend probably will be a good environment for many people to not think about the state of the country and the election and politics. And having that has been, for many communities, an important distraction for them, an outlet for the way that people are feeling, not just in the US, but throughout the country, and people who are living under different regimes throughout history. You know, sports have been a very, very important outlet. And I do think it's important to weave politics into the sports as well, and not say that we're just going to, you know, stick to sports or whatever, but also not underestimate the important power that sports do have in a community like the United States, but then also throughout societies and governments of all kinds and people who are living in those places.
True. And I mean, I don't think that, you know, the point is not, I'm going to retire from sports writing here. The point is,
you literally are a sports writer.
A, understanding, like, the stakes here, the stakes in a game are not the same as the stakes in an election, and not to take things so seriously, and, you know, not to create the kind of even sports hatred I think is somewhat problematic in this context, but also to kind of use that platform. And I certainly think there's been a lot of things implicit within my work for a long period of time, but I think that going forward, that a lot of them need to be more explicit.
Interesting. For me right now, in this moment, I've just been thinking about communities and, you know, the communities that we have and that we've built to support us, and people that do think like-minded. And it's one of those moments when you see just how overwhelming maybe people who didn't think the same as we felt this past week seems to be. But it has me looking at those communities, both people in family, friendship, work, clients, colleagues, things like that. But then also the PeltonCast community on the Discord, and having a group of people who get together to have smart conversations about sports and bicker, and who
not
also
just sports though. I mean, the amazing thing about the PeltonCast Discord is, like, the carbon impact of hydroelectric power came up last week on the Discord, and we have
I'm sorry that I had to bring it up.
The listener is an expert in hydroelectric power. Like, it's an amazing community in this regard.
Yeah, no, and it's definitely special to find those communities and to make sure that you're letting people know that you appreciate them within there, and then also to support and nurture those communities that are doing good for people as both an outlet from politics, but then also a place to have these conversations and organize. And the other thing that I've been thinking about is making sure in this moment that we're highlighting the successes and just the ongoing, performance of people from marginalized communities. And I think that's something that is the most important for us in the Peloton cast. And, I think we're one of the podcasts that is talking the most about the Seattle Storm, UW women's basketball, people like that, in a time when it might feel like nobody cares about these things or everybody is against them, to be a place that we're having these conversations and highlighting those things. And then also being, open to highlighting people from many different marginalized communities and having those conversations on this podcast. I think that's what our goal is, our stated goal is, to separate us from a strictly Mariners podcast or a strictly Seahawks podcast. That is not in any of our interests, despite the fact that maybe it would be a larger community if it was. Maybe we'd have a larger TikTok channel or something. But ultimately, like, we're doing this because of the community and not for any sort of, large listenership or success. That Pagliacci money isn't so good. And it's also just pizza. So really the reason
But
that we're
we're
doing
so
this.
thankful to
Oh no,
Pagliacci
not
for
and of
that
course,
amazing pizza.
obviously appreciate Pagliacci. But it's not like this is neither of our jobs. And it's about having an opportunity to highlight those communities and to build this community. And I think that's something that we hold really, really close here on the Peloton Cast, and obviously we'll continue to do so.
I want to come back to the marginalized voices, but what you said naturally transitions into, look, I was ambivalent about whether to even do a podcast this week, which would have, I guess, been 3 out of 5 weeks without one had we not. But shout out to the listener, Chris Wheeler, Big Fiscal on the Discord, for his message today. For what it's worth, this pod and its accompanying community have been a source of joy, commiseration, and Mariners hot takes for me for years. I know you'll never stick to sports the way that some might, and I respect and appreciate that, but I do look forward to hot takes of whatever variety you guys care to share. In as much as you feel capable of it and moved to do it, your Seattle sports commentary and occasionally shockingly bad food takes. We gotta go back to that one. Would
Occasionally
be.
shockingly bad food takes. I'm guessing that's you.
Oh, I don't think it's. I mean, I can
Each
see
of us
that
think
there.
it's the other
I
person.
can no, I can see that there are some of my food takes that are shockingly bad. I'm just saying it's not exclusive to me. Would be a welcome distraction for me, and I suspect for others during a tough time. And if you can't do it, that's okay too.
Much like much of the country this week, we're like, oh, the food takes are bad, but not my food takes.
We're talking about other food takes.
They don't apply to me.
I mean, I think the other thing is, look, this is not just a sports podcast. It's a sports and food and culture podcast. And
And
food is particularly a place where we can,
hydroplanes?
well, that's part of
A false set of
sports.
sports? Okay.
Also not, I
I'm
mean,
trying to
better
think of what the
now.
most random things that we talk about are on an annual
Geography.
basis. Geography.
But food is another place where it's like it actually matters financially for us to highlight, underrepresented communities. So I think that's, another important element of what we're trying to do here and what we want to continue to do. And the other thing I've been thinking about a lot in the last 24 plus hours, and as we record this on Wednesday night, and going back to 2016, this was a thought as well, is look, if we as a collective society are not going to be capable of providing some of the, the services to the less fortunate that, I think we think are part of a successful government, then I do think that's incumbent upon us to step up and do individually with our donations and that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
And I mean, as a podcast, I think it's important, that's part of specifically what I say, to continue to support Planned Parenthood in this moment where women's reproductive rights are not secured and we're not valued. So
So all that is to say, when we argue about sports, it's because people told us we had to this week.
because people told us it was important. Are we going to argue about sports this week?
I don't know. We probably could. It's just been like really, it was not lost on me that the same day as the election was also the first college football playoff where Oregon was announced as the number one seed right now, the first college football playoff rankings. It was really just, it was a night. It's not like I was surprised by it,
And
but.
a belated, by the way, as we transition into the toast, a belated happy birthday to our mother who celebrated her birthday
Oh,
on
God.
Tuesday night. Oh boy.
At least I got jury duty.
You got jury duty?
Yeah. My
Are
little
you
jury summons for November 21st and 22nd in Renton,
going
Washington.
to treat it like the show? I don't know what that would actually entail.
Like I'm like a not I'm a celebrity who's there. Is that
Yes, that's how you're gonna treat
how
it.
do you plan on making this
I don't
happen?
know. I just thought it was a funny reference.
Okay, fair enough.
All right. Again, I don't know if I'm in a toasting mood, but some good things did happen in Seattle sports in the past weekend, and I suppose we should celebrate those successes where they happened. Congrats to Carson Bruner, who was named Big Ten Defensive Player of the Week after recording 12 tackles, a pair of interceptions in Saturday's UW football win over USC. This is somebody who has been part of the UW program a long time and has never played a better game than he did on Saturday.
Yeah, that was awesome to see. And you know, the second pick in particular, like one of the most timely of the season. We've had a couple of big ones at home, but that one was freaking huge.
And with some stakes on the line in
Saying that
terms
he's
of,
been part of the UW football program for a long time is almost an understatement for
yeah.
Carson Bruner, because clearly grew up as part of the UW program.
Well, yes, that is true, given his dad is a legend here as well. I mean, look, Carson is not going to go down probably quite at the same level as Mark, who was part of the 91 championship team, if I recall correctly.
I actually, I'm not, I feel like Mark Bruner was more notable for his NFL play because he did have a long NFL career than even necessarily what he accomplished at UW as a tight end. I think Carson Bruner, he's not the type of player who's probably going to have a like glorious NFL career, but I think he is somebody who his on-field impact probably will be more important. If there was like a college football war, I think that Carson Bruner's would probably be higher than Mark Bruner's.
I don't know. I mean, we didn't have the PFF run block grades for Mark Bruner. He peaked at 30 catches for 414 yards in 1993 and 3 touchdowns as a junior. I mean, you're right that like tight ends just didn't have the sort of the same statistical impact in the college game back then that they do
And Carson
now.
Bruner's just been really good too. That's not an insult to Mark Bruner. It's a compliment to how good Carson Bruner has been. I'll be
Yeah.
fascinated to see if he is an NFL player.
I mean,
I
it's wild
think
because
he'll make a roster.
this is his first year as a starter. It's kind of wild.
It's definitely a bit of a testament. I mean, I've been thinking about this so much about how experience is something. We've talked about this on the podcast, but experience matters a lot. Also, one of the other big plays of the game was made by a freshman, so I don't want to
Yeah,
overstate that.
Kamori House, who had a crucial fourth down stop at the goal line.
But also Carson Bruner is taking time in the program, being through multiple coaches at the program, and finally having his opportunity and having a monster senior season.
I mean, the two best UW football teams in our lifetime, the thing they have in common is a Bruner.
That's true.
All right, congrats to Dylan Moore and Cal Raleigh, who were chosen AL Gold Glove recipients at utility and catcher, respectively. Ems had not had a Gold Glove winner since 2020 when both J.P. Crawford and Evan White were honored.
Woo. It's fun.
This is cool for them.
I really like Cal Raleigh also, and it was cool to see him be honored for it. It's just on this week of all weeks, I'm not willing to get that excited about the Mariners. I'm sorry.
Fair. Congrats to Kelsey Plum, whose number 10 jersey will be retired by UW on January 18th against Purdue, making her the first women's basketball player in UW history with the honor.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure. Rhonda Smith, I guess, would probably have been the best candidate before Plum.
I mean,
I'd have
obviously
to
Plum is the
think on
greatest
that.
player in UW women's basketball history.
Is Plum the greatest player in UW basketball history now? I mean, she was the all-time leading
All-time
scorer
points leader.
in,
Yeah.
but also like pro career, like the UW men who have had strong careers have typically tended to, have very short peaks, unfortunately, due to injury in the case of Brandon Roy and Isaiah Thomas. I mean, Detlef Schrempf,
Yeah,
had
Detlef.
an amazing career in his own right. But Kelsey Plum, three-time All-Star, two-time WNBA champion, gold medalist, like she probably has to be it now.
The greatest basketball player in UW history.
First number one pick, Markelle Fultz, obviously on the men's side, months later followed her. Pretty incredible. So she was at the UW football game on Saturday. It was cool to see her there. And she will be back in January.
It would be very fun if she ever found her way to the Storm, if there is a possibility of that happening even later in her career.
Right. All right, lastly, sticking. Oh no, we've got a few more. Wait. Congrats to UW Volleyball, which beat number 10 Oregon for their first top 10 win since 2021.
That hasn't been that long.
It's still a
Well,
good period of time. Congrats to UW Men's.
it's volleyball, so they play a lot of top 10 teams.
It's
There are a
true.
lot of opportunities.
Congrats to UW Men's Soccer, which beat number 25 UCLA 1-0 in LA Sunday to finish as the number 4 seed in the Big Ten tournament, which kicks off Thursday in Bridgeview, Illinois. Huskies will face number 5 seed Michigan State in the quarterfinals. UW Women also going to be in action in their first Big Ten tournament, I believe, possibly also on Thursday. They are playing in St. Louis, that classic Big Ten hub. And they are taking on UCLA.
I'm reading about the next person on the list.
All right, lastly this week, we are remembering Quincy Jones, who died Sunday at age 91. The legendary music producer and just music fixture, spent his teenage years in Seattle, graduating from Garfield High School, whose Performing Arts Center is named after him in 1951. I mean, it's pretty like defining Quincy Jones's career, his legacy, his impact on music. It's we'd need several whole podcasts, I think, to go through all of that.
Yeah, and kind of incredible that he spent time in Seattle of all places
The
for
thing I
Quincy
didn't
Jones.
realize, did you know this? That he was friends with Ray Charles in Seattle?
No, that's incredible to be friends. I mean, honestly, the fact that both like two in black music, that two so prominent figures met in Seattle, Washington, is,
Exactly.
and that of all of the most important figures in Seattle music between Ray Charles, Jimi Hendrix, Quincy Jones, that a city as generally white as Seattle has had three of the most prominent figures in black music over the last 100 years. It's kind of incredible. And having those two both, they went to the same high school, right? They both went to Garfield. Or
Jimmy?
all three, right? Or
Ray
did
Charles
Ray
didn't
Charles?
attend high school here.
Okay.
He was here as a young adult. He was older than Quincy Jones at the time
But
they first
Jimi
met.
Hendrix and Quincy Jones. And I think the trio of albums that he produced, the Michael Jackson albums, which really skyrocketed him from important producer to biggest producer in the entire world, but Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad, probably the most unassailable trio of albums in a row in all of music history, in all of pop music history, at the very least. And for Quincy Jones to have produced those, obviously Thriller maybe being the most important album of all time, and to have produced that plus the two around it, and really have guided Michael Jackson through that part of his career where he was maybe the most famous person in the entire world, is pretty incredible. And those albums also are not like they are vehicles for Michael Jackson, but they're musical albums in a way that a lot of pop music isn't necessarily. You know, like Michael Jackson's the voice and he's obviously the star of it, but you could listen to it from a perspective of, then they're weird too. You know, like a song like Thriller being on the most popular album of all time, being the title track to that, and just how important it is now. It's a strange song. All things considered, it's not a middle of the road pop song. And I think that's kind of the awesome thing about Quincy Jones, because there is some sort of like soft rock, light pop on Thriller, but that there's those types of tracks and that there's heavy tracks on there as well. There are rock songs in there. It was a pretty unassailable run.
Yeah, so farewell to Quincy Jones. Had an incredible life and an incredible legacy. All right, as we get into our sports, I don't know, into our sports notes, I guess. We have this week an NBA Seattle update sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza related to the NBA's game in Mexico City last week. And while he was there, Commissioner Adam Silver spoke to The Athletic and had a few comments that related to expansion in Mexico City's place in that obviously are relevant to Seattle as well. Being direct, he said, it's highly unlikely Mexico City would jump above U.S. cities that are currently under consideration. But at the same time, once we move into expansion mode and start looking at all the considerations that go with expansion, I think that would then allow us to have more of a template to understand whether a city in Mexico City, like Mexico City, I should say, would be suitable. And also said the timeline was well down the road for Mexico City. And that's notable because one of the things that came up when Tim Von Temps and Brian Windhorst and I were reporting out our story on NBA expansion a couple months ago, was Seattle and Vegas are obviously the heavy favorites. If anyone, any other team, any other city was to potentially get an expansion team, it would have been Mexico City. So if they're not, you know, seriously in consideration this time around, that's definitely good news for Seattle. And then the Athletic's Joe Varden also paraphrased Silver to say, in outlining the league's process for expansion to the Athletic, Silver said, if the front office determined it wanted to add teams, the matter would be referred to an existing committee of owners. The owners would solicit input from consultants who would conduct market viability studies of all potential expansion cities. Finalists would emerge, and from there, the league would engage potential ownership groups based on the location identified by the owners committee. So that's kind of the clearest, the process, I think, has been laid out in this entire thing. But you can tell from that, there's a lot of steps between just the NBA starts to consider expansion, which, you know, Silver did, I think, also say in that internal process of should we take it to a committee has begun already at the league office. But there's several steps between that and awarding expansion franchises, let alone having them play.
But still looking fairly positive.
I think so. It's just a question of the timing.
There was just an incredible paragraph on the Quincy Jones Wikipedia. Did you read through this?
I mean, I have, but which one in particular?
It starts with Ray Charles introducing him to heroin at the age of 15, yes. Although he stopped using it after 5 months. A believer in astrology and regard to religion, he stated in February 2018 that he believed in a God that opposes the love of money, thank you, Q, but dismisses the notion of an afterlife. He held a negative opinion of the Catholic Church. It was just like just dropped in there as a paragraph about Quincy Jones. It's pretty incredible.
Jones claimed to have knowledge of the truth of the Kennedy assassination. Yes, yeah. Quincy Jones's late era interviews, wide ranging. I think you would fairly describe them, and truly one of a kind.
Yep. Yeah.
And memorable, like everything else Quincy Jones did. All right, Seattle Mariners have officially declined their 2025 team option for Jorge Polanco worth $12 million, will instead pay him a $750K buyout. MLB free agency is sort of upon us, although obviously a very slow-moving free agency in contrast to its NBA and NHL counterpart.
So NFL free agents can start signing contracts now.
I'd have to double-check this, but I think we're pretty close. I guess we've got a few days, maybe.
I mean, the date that is really the most important date is the, you know, the owner meetings, the winter meetings that happen in mid-December. And that's when things kind of start to heat up generally. There was a report today, I believe, for Buster Olner and Jeff Passan that Juan Soto was expected to sign around that time period. And Soto being the biggest domino, probably, you know, additional ones will start falling at that point. If you thought that the Mariners were going to be in the mix for any big name free agents, which they probably are not.
I would even go stronger than that. They definitely will not be.
Definitely. I'm not willing to go that far.
You wouldn't?
No. I mean,
players can sign with new teams. It's 5 days after the World Series is the starting point for that. So that would have been Monday. Probably not anything else going on right around then. The other deadline that sort of spurs this is the date for qualifying offers, and that's up until November 19th for players who are eligible for those.
I just, looking at MLB free
agency. That's the day where they have to decide whether to accept or decline. That already, Monday was the deadline to tender the qualifying offers, I should say.
Looking at MLB, I mean, what is the answer at second base right now?
Question mark.
Okay.
I mean,
what is the answer at third base right now?
Well, Josh Rojas is still around.
But what is the answer at first base right now?
Tyler
Locklear,
I suppose.
Luke Raley.
The Mariners are going to add some players. The Mariners some players. Ryan Bliss would be an option at second base, certainly, if they wanted to go cheaper and go in house. I mean, Dylan Moore does not currently have a specific position. He's going to, at the very least, presumably be part of a platoon at either second base or third base.
I mean,
like, if the Mariners had to start the season tomorrow, they could do it. They could field a roster. But yes, they're clearly going to add some players.
That's the standard for the Mariners?
Well, I mean, it's not like, you know, it wouldn't be in no holes But if you're starting Dylan Moore at second, Josh Rojas at third, and Luke Rayleigh at first, that doesn't look that different than the rosters, the lineups last season. But again, they will certainly be adding at least a player or two. Seems like a lot of speculation that Justin Turner will be back at first base for one more season, which would make sense. Then, you have the right-handed bat there to go with Luke Rayleigh as the left-handed bat.
But just looking at the, say, the Fangraphs top 50 free agents of the year, it's basically the way that it's like, do you need a kind of old starting pitcher or do you need a kind of older relief pitcher? You know, that's really who's out there unless you're willing to spend at a very premium price. And, you know, MLB free agency, I just don't, after looking at it, if you're able to sign somebody like Juan Soto or Willy Adames or somebody like that, maybe even Bregman, I know there's a lot of question marks around Bregman, but if you're able to sign the one or two best free agents that there are in the offseason, then that is a good way to build a team. People have proven that. The Dodgers have proven that. They've made trades for a lot of their roster, but they've also signed a player like Shohei in free agency. For most organizations, that's just not a good place to go do it, to go get those star players. And I hope, you know, the Mariners have tried to in these last couple of seasons patch it together with players who are in this shorter term deals, smaller budget way. And
Coming off of down years.
after seeing, I just ultimately, I don't think that strategy has worked. Even when they've found players, you know, they haven't. I think Gino Suarez basically was a throw-in, obviously, in the trade that they got Jesse Winker in. Teoscar Hernandez didn't perform well. I actually had a question for you about this, though. I was reading about Teoscar Hernandez said that now World Series winner Teo,
Toast to Teo. I guess that. Has it happened since we last recorded? I haven't the slightest clue when we last recorded.
home run derby champion, seems very happy in LA, probably will get a very large deal this offseason. He said he had a hard time picking up the ball in Seattle. And my question for you is, why don't they just fix that? Why is that, like, because it's if it's not anything to do, if the issue isn't just the marine layer, if hitters are striking out here because they're having a hard time picking up the ball, which I think we have enough evidence to suggest that that is probably the case. I get that it makes the pitching stats look better, but ultimately, I think as a team and an organization, you'd feel better if hitters were able to come here and to feel good. But seeing a player like Teoscar Hernandez, if I was a free agent, I wouldn't sign in Seattle. If I had, I would
Of course
need
not.
such a massive premium to be willing to come here. And, you know, to have your value torpedoed basically because of it, where you need to go to another city. And you see what Gino did, and you see what Teo did in these other cities and how much better they were. Why can't the Mariners fix that? Or do they just not want to fix it?
I mean, I don't think this is a simple one. I do think there's a possibility that there's something that could be done in terms of making the batter's eye square to home plate in a way that is currently not. But I don't know the logistics of T-Mobile Park in the way that the Mariners organization does. So this is a
What does that
situation.
mean, batter's eye square to home plate?
So, if you look at it in most places, even places that have asymmetrical fences, center field, like the backdrop behind it, is still like it's perpendicular to the line that goes between home plate to second base. And if you look at a map of T-Mobile Park, it is not that. It is at an angle to it.
So did they
And
just biff it in the construction of the park?
I don't think until the park actually opened, they quite realized how that was going to play out. And then there were some additional, issues with the color of that backdrop and maybe the reflective nature of it. I can't remember exactly that they did address after the first few years. And we saw at that point, if you look at it on the Statcast page, the strikeout rate relative to league average at T-Mobile Park was enormous in the first few years. And then it was like it was high, but not excessively high for a couple decades. And then the last few years, it has been off the charts again, as we've discussed on this podcast.
So something must have changed during this time period because I think.
Again, I've theorized that it may have something to do with moving the start times from 7:10 to 6:40, not because that's an obvious huge factor,
It
but
just lines
because
up timing wise.
it's the thing that's changed.
Yeah. It just seems like to me rather than overhauling the roster, which is an expensive proposition, it would be easier to overhaul the ballpark.
I agree.
They
I just don't
must
know what the
know that
logistics
this
are.
is an issue.
I think the Mariners front office has a lot of people who are paying very close attention to this, much closer than me and you.
I'm trying to like look at the batter's eye. So there's home plate straight through. There's a bit of an like a bend in the fence pretty close to center field.
Correct, although that's not necessarily specifically the issue. It's more about the way that
The background, straight right next to the.
the stands in center field are not perpendicular.
So when you're looking for them being at an angle and the screen or whatever that is that's in center field, is that black or is that green right now?
I think it's black.
Okay. For some reason in my head, I think of it as green. But the stands possibly being in an angle and not like curved around there, it just doesn't really make any sense. Like, could they build it up higher? Like,
I mean, I
I
suggested that you could put some sort of a facade, a word I really understand now that I've been to Italy and seen what facades of churches look like. Like, it's a weekly tradition at this point.
goes to Italy one time, comes back an expert on facades.
I just like I never really conceptualized it until you see that, like, you look at the front, it's all marble, and then you look at the side, and it's like, wait a second. That's not actually all marble.
That's right. I've been going to New York a lot more this year, and I came back, or now I'm like, I understand why there was a how-to with John Wilson about scaffolding.
There's a lot of scaffolding. So if you could build a facade that was square to home plate, you would take out some of like the usable area in that is growing grass, I believe, in that center field area. But I think that that would
Put up
probably be worth
like
it.
a big wall right there in front of it.
But it wouldn't have to be like a completely filled in wall. It would just have to be the front so that that's what batters see. I don't know. That's, again, I'm not an expert here.
They should be trying out everything in this moment.
I agree. Everything should be on the table. Well, you
I
know
mean,
who else?
it's one of those questions that we talked about last week. You were going to have such a great transition, I'm sure. You're going to be like, you know what else I've been to in the last month? Still Italy.
It was not going to be an Italy reference this time, I promise.
But
That's
it's
my promise to you, the listener.
one of those things that there's a problem that, and the Mariners aren't complaining to the fans. They're not like, this is your fault that the hitters are striking out. So that's something. But it is a problem that's
They are
happening.
saying we're doing you a favor. I mean, they were just like, this is not Jerry DePoto's fault. They were very obsessed with, like, oh, it can't be even dimensions because the even though the kingdom wasn't actually even dimensions, it had like a giant, a giant wall in right field. But they were very committed to the, like, it's got to be like the 1920s when they designed things like this because there really was no other space.
Why?
They were committed to the bet. And look, I get it.
Committed to the
Who could have
bit.
foreseen that some 25 years later that free agents would not want to sign with the Mariners because they strike out so much here.
I mean, so the kingdom, the walls may be higher. There's like the light blue fence and then the dark blue wall. It definitely extends further, but the stands are kind of rounded behind there.
Which I think is, again, fairly typical of most stadiums.
Yeah. It's basically they tried to model it. They tried to do like a Field of Dreams thing, I guess, or something like.
I think it's supposed to be like Ebbets Field or something like that, that was like literally built into a city block. And I mean, not that T-Mobile was not contained within a city block, but like had to be the size it was because of the dimensions of everything around it.
And they were like, we're going to build this tiny, tiny field, and then other people will have the opportunity to build stadiums all around here, but we're going to block them.
Well,
The Mariners deserve this.
you know what's being blocked a lot?
What's that?
Seattle Kraken shots.
Wow.
I was going with they need to try everything. That was the earlier transition. After scoring 8 goals in their road trip opener in Montreal, they combined for one over the next 3 games and lost the final 4 games on their road trip. They are now 5-8-1, tied for 12th place in the West. Good news, they get a couple of days off before beginning a 6-game homestand Friday against the Vegas Golden Knights, the first matchup of the season. between the two most recent expansion teams and de facto rivals. Seattle Sounders, we didn't toast to this, but certainly deserve congratulations. They are on in the MLS Cup playoffs, having not managed to outscore the Houston Dynamo in either of their two matches in the MLS mini-series. On Sunday, they played without both Jordan Morris and Albert Rusnak, who had a hip injury that came up in training on Friday. Raul Ruiz Diaz got the start for Morris, with Christian Roldan moving into attacking midfield and João Paulo staying in the starting lineup alongside Obed Vargas as defensive mids, with the latter returning from red card suspension. Frankly, Houston dominated the first two-thirds of this game and probably should have scored some tremendous saves from Stefan Fry. But the game changed dramatically when Hector Herrera was sent off in the 66th minute after responding to a yellow card by spitting at the referee, thus earning a second yellow.
Wow.
The Sounders finally broke through Houston's 10-man defense, the second consecutive game, again, that the Dynamo were reduced to 10 men. In the 87th minute, with Christian Roldan finishing a Nuhu feed, a terrific feed by Nuhu, but Houston immediately began creating chances again and found the equalizer in the second minute of stoppage time, which was well deserved, frankly. They had 20 shots, 7 on goal, massive XG. So it was back to penalties for a second consecutive game. A seeming Stefan Fry save was overturned after VAR ruled he was off the line. Both teams were therefore perfect through the six kicks. After the Sounders make, Fry came up with a save, and the Sounders are on to the MLS Cup quarterfinals. Or the Western Conference semifinals, I guess they as they call it. An important thing we need to discuss. Houston's keeper, Steve Clark, longtime member of the Portland Timbers, you may recall him from there, is now sporting a rat tail. And I promised on the Discord that we would reference your time with a rat tail. This was pre you dressing up as Messi. This was when you were dressing up as Steve Clark.
I was dressing up as Steve Clark in like
That
1992.
was the joke. That's
I'm
why.
just I'm just gonna say I had the rat tail in, I want to say, second grade, something like that. And I feel like I was a little bit ahead of the times.
Probably.
Rat tail, at least during the like DIY punk era, like 2006 to 2010, rat tails were everywhere. I couldn't go anywhere without seeing a rat tail, and they were all cool.
Are you sure about that?
So I'm just telling you, I could have showed up at like Cairo Gallery with hammer pants and a rat tail,
You did love the hammer pants back then.
and I would have looked amazing. I would
In
have fit in so normally.
your Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles era, I was personally so traumatized by your rat tail that I don't even like it when my hair isn't rounded off at the bottom, because I'm
Really?
concerned it will somehow seem too much like a rat tail.
I'm just gonna throw this out there. You reach certain points in your life where you're like, that's just never gonna happen for me again. Like, there's different things where you're like, I remember when I was like not a teenager and I was like, I'm not gonna have a teen pregnancy. And I was like, I have moved past this phase of my life. Not me personally. But
Yeah, I've got some news.
I've got some news for you. I don't think you could have a rat tail if you tried.
Oh, what? Well, I could definitely have a rat tail if I tried.
I don't think you could. I
This is
think
a
you've moved
luscious
past the
thick head of
age.
hair.
But a rat tail, your hair is not conducive to rat tailing, also, the type of hair you have.
I suppose. I don't know. I've never really grown it particularly long, so I
But
don't
then look,
know what
I
it
don't
would
mean
be
to
like.
stifle you. You know what I mean?
No, you're I mean
If
you're
it
I'm not
if you
going to do
want to
it.
grow a rat tail, please grow a rat tail. But I'm telling you, you can't. I'm here to stifle you.
As
Me
much as I
though,
want to disprove you.
I could grow a rat tail anytime. It's just like having a mustache for a little while. You're like, I did that now. Like I've done this
You check that box.
in my life. The other thing, tell you something about elections. One thing that I've been thinking about also, which
I've got
is
the finger on the delete button right now.
less somber. We're so old.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
Every person I talk to, I'm like, yeah, I remember voting for John Kerry in 2004 and being devastated about it. You know what I mean? I'm so old school. Like, there's obviously people who are way more old school who freaking they hated Ronald Reagan or whatever. They hated George H.W. Bush. But I'm like, I'm George W. Bush hatred level old.
Well, the Sounders don't yet know their opponent in the Western Conference semifinals. They will face the winner of LAFC and Vancouver, who are headed to a deciding third game on Friday after the Whitecaps won 3-0 at home on Sunday night. Sounders will have 2 weekends off before that matchup, the weekend of November 23rd,
Oh,
because there's an obviously an international
international
break.
break of the playoffs. Chef's kiss.
Brian Schmetzer on
Best
the
of
health.
three soccer series in the first round. Follow it up with an international break. Let's go, MLS.
Brian Schmetzer on the benefit of the break for the health of Morris and Rushnak. We'll have to wait until the final schedule comes out, but that's plenty of time for those guys to ramp up again.
Basically next season.
Well, we are on to next season for Seattle Reign FC. He had goals from Jordan Heidema and Maddie Mercado in their season finale, the latter, her first NWSL regular season goal, but still fell 3-2 to the Shield winning Orlando Pride. The result dropped the Reign to 13th in the final NWSL standings, ahead of only the Houston Dash, and ready to turn the page on this one and start fresh in 2025. Well, starting fresh, UW basketball got its season openers the last 2 nights. On Monday, it was a 95-53 win for the women over Seattle U, a game they led 18-1 at the start and 28-3 after one quarter. I wondered if it was a typo. It was not. Every UW player scored in the first half. Four starters and reserve Tegan Brown scored double figures. They made 10 threes at a 37% clip and grabbed 15 of a possible 31 offensive rebounds. We saw transfer Tyra Eke start at center next to incumbent Dalea Daniels, who had been playing center the last couple of seasons in a bigger lineup. She had 6 boards in 13 minutes to help pace that attack on the glass. The lone downside for the Huskies, 20 turnovers. And one bit of news before the Huskies continue the season, they'll host Pacific on Thursday, Siena on Sunday. German post Annika Soltau, who was a highly regarded incoming recruit, I saw her play in the Nike Hoop Summit back in April, decided over the summer to turn pro rather than joining the Huskies. So a bit of a
Did we
blow to
just
their
find out
front court
about
depth.
that?
It happened. It had been announced back then. I had missed it until I was looking at the roster and like, what's missing here? Something
Do we
seems
feel
off.
like this win ha does this win matter at all?
This individual win? No. I mean, how they played quite well.
That's what I'm
That's good.
saying. Like, does this win, is this win possibly portentous? Where do the UW women rank in Big Ten preseason rankings, or do they not have those for, they must for women?
I'm sure they do. Probably pretty low. Big 10, Big Pac-12 was quite good at women's basketball. The Big 10 also quite good, in part because they imported the two best teams in USC and UCLA, who were both ranked in the top five to start the season. They played in doubleheader in Paris on Monday to get things
USC and
open.
UCLA did
Yeah, USC
against
was
each other or against
no,
other
they
teams?
were separate games, doubleheader. So USC was quite tested in that opener by Ole Miss, but did hold on to win. And UCLA was very impressive without the injured Kiki Rice. The preseason, they only listed the top five in the preseason rankings. That's kind of weird. So obviously the Huskies were not in the top five. If we go to
Who are the top five?
USC, UCLA, Ohio State, Maryland, and Indiana.
You're welcome, Big Ten. I mean,
On
this is.
threes rankings, scrolling through these, Iowa, by the way, ranked sixth there without Caitlin Clark. UW ranked 12th out of the 18 Big Ten
Not terrible.
teams.
Yeah, it is funny having literally Caitlin Clark's team in the Big Ten as well. I didn't even think about that. This is Juju Watkins' season, though, right? She is the undisputed number one player and
No,
all. Really?
Paige
No.
Beckers.
Paige Bekker still?
Yeah. I mean, she's the one who's gonna be the number one pick. Like
Okay.
Juju's not it would be fascinating if they both could be in the draft. That's not like a knock on Juju Watkins, but it's the two of them are the co-headliners of this women's basketball season.
Juju Watkins will be next year.
Yes.
How often do women's college basketball players come out early? Because that's only her junior year, right?
Correct, but we will have a new WNBA collective bargaining agreement by then, and we will see whether draft eligibility is one of the topics that gets addressed.
You can come out after your junior season, can't you?
Only if you have already graduated from college. And then I
Interesting.
think there may be an age qualification on top of that. But again, all of this is potentially changing. Now, what has been a question for a long period of time is like, especially with NIL, would players choose to stay for a fifth year that they've had access to rather than come out after four, rather than players coming out after three? But as the finances of the WNBA change with its new collective bargaining agreement, I think that also could be something that could change.
WNBA salaries are going up fairly significantly, right?
And it would be basically impossible for them not to.
I mean, seeing Juju Watkins, like her Instagram, she's represented by Clutch. So I think she's probably doing fine right now.
She's doing great.
But I do think they'll still, and playing in LA on, I don't know. I would guess that USC women are probably the most important women's college or women's basketball team in LA. Over the Sparks.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, unless they get the draft lottery and win the draft lottery and get to draft Paige Packers. So if Juju were somehow able to come out after her junior year, if something were to change or that were to take place, that would be the 2026 draft. When you will recall, the Seattle Storm owns the Los Angeles Sparks first round pick. And I talked to someone in the league last week who said they thought that was an incredible trade for the Storm and they could not believe the Sparks would give up that pick.
Okay.
So, for all your Angel Reese and Ricky Jackson naysaying, that's the counter perspective.
Where do you land on it? I mean, it's sort of a, you have to judge it before seeing what the pick is
Right.
necessarily. You have to judge the process. And
I mean, LA is sitting here. They do not have a coach. They, are, other than this draft pick, going to be hard pressed, I think, to improve next season in free agency. I think the odds are very high that it ends up in the lottery.
Cameron Brink will also be back.
Yeah.
Okay. I would love to be proven wrong.
UW men's basketball played at Tuesday night in obviously the most monumental event that took place then, hosting UC Davis. They trailed
Nate
58.
Duncan tweeted the whole time.
Oh no.
Great
They
rebound
trailed
by Great
58.
Osabor.
Trailed 58-53 with 7 minutes left. It felt very much like a UW men's basketball season opener. Like the coaches, the players, they come and go. UW men's basketball shooting terribly from three in their
Oh,
season
God.
opener is a time-honored tradition unlike any other. They were 2 for 14, both of the makes coming from Mekhi Mason in this one. But then when
I'm scared for our country, but this is great Osabor content.
Then went on a 9-0 run to take the lead for good and ended up winning 69-63 against UC Davis. It was an active debut for Great Osabor, who had 15 points, 17 rebounds, and 6 steals, but also 9 missed free throws and 6 turnovers in his season opener, his UW debut. Notably from the box score, Mekhi Mason was the only of the guard starters to score more than 4 points. That was partially because Zoum Diallo came up pretty big in his UW debut as a freshman off the bench, 12 points in 26 minutes for Zoum Diallo. We're keeping an eye on the role of Tyler Harris, who we expected to be a big part of this team. We expected to be the starting power forward. He is not. Had 12 minutes off the bench in the opener. A big lift, I would say. Did score 9 points, by the way, Tyler Harris. A big lift from Wilhelm Breidenbach, who played 20 minutes off the bench, scored 10 points on 5 of 5 shooting.
Yeah, it was. There we go.
Love to see that. Huskies dropped 3 spots in KenPom as a result of this game being close.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's exciting to see Zoum Diallo do something, obviously
Yeah.
as a freshman, and play well. So
Had 4 assists as well, a team high.
I'm excited to monitor that, and then also just to see if UW can shoot in the season going forward. I had this game on for a second, but I will tell you, it was like I was playing, I had this on. I could not pay attention to it. I was playing Mario Kart. The battles, they were not going well. I got no coins and coin runners. So there were some things that I was just like not capable of doing on this particular night. And UW basketball was one of those things.
I think that is completely fair.
When do they come back again, though?
Well, it's gonna the schedule is one other note on this one. Luis Courtright, who is another of the guard transfers, didn't play in the exhibition game, which is why Christian King, I think, played a much bigger role in that one. King barely played in the season opener. Courtright was kind of the third guy off the bench behind Zu Diallo and Wilhelm Breidenbach. So another experienced player to add to the backcourt. But again, Christian King's kind of noted for his shooting. Another move that sort of seems to downgrade the Husky shooting. But we'll learn a lot more about the Huskies on Saturday night when they make an early trip to Reno to play Nevada, coming off a 26-win season that ended in the opening round of the NCAA tournament. They cruised past Sam Houston State 91-75 at home in their opener. They returned two starters from last year's team, including post Nick Davidson, who had 26 points on 8 of 10 shooting, 10 boards in the opener, while Cal Poly transfer Kobe Sanders had a team high 27 points on 9 of 14 shooting.
What time is this game? I'm looking it up. 7 p.m. Okay.
Yeah.
So it does overlap with UW football a little bit. Are they also playing Nevada too? You said Nevada?
Sure.
Okay.
It's on the Mountain West Network. I don't know if we have access to that.
The Mountain West. Okay. What is NSN? What network is that?
NSN?
NSN.
I don't know. Is one of the games on that?
Yeah, that's what it's listed as Mountain Nevada Sportsnet.
Okay.
They could I obviously UW football is on Peacock, right? And they probably don't have two things on Peacock, I suppose, or maybe just Nevada has the rights to it because it's there.
Yeah,
But
the home team gets the rights to it.
maybe not every conference needs a network.
I think very clearly not every conference needs to
Mountain
know.
West Network.
Oh, I didn't realize that was Peacock exclusive for UW Penn State. People must be freaking out about that.
Is UW what the Apple Cup was Peacock exclusive, right?
Correct.
Okay. And Michigan also, or no?
No, Michigan was on the network NBC. I watched that on NBC.
So, because you weren't there, they are 1-1 in games exclusively on Peacock. Is that right?
Yes, the Michigan State win.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
Well, should
we've
we
learned
transfer?
nothing.
Should we transfer over here to UW football?
Do we have a percentage chance of victory against UNLV? Maybe it's KenPom's.
KenPom says the Huskies are 6-point underdogs in this game and gives them a 30% chance of winning.
Okay, it's not terrible.
Not at UNLV, though. All right, UW football, 26-21 win Saturday against USC, a game that was boy. So you brought two of your three children, and your youngest son Mateo, went through quite an emotional journey with us during this one, when the rain started, and he demanded to go home after demanding for weeks to go to the game,
He worked
turning.
hard for weeks to go to the game. It wasn't like he didn't just demand. He did great in school for multiple weeks. He avoided conflict, and there's a lot that look, if you are a second grade progressive, there's a lot of conflict inside of that elementary school for you. And he
Oh
avoided
boy.
all of that conflict to come to this football game. And then asked to go home in the second quarter. No,
Demanding.
it was particularly heinous weather.
It's weird because I don't think it was like the worst weather we'd ever seen or anything. It was just like I was told there might be a little rain. I wasn't told that it was going to be like pouring rain or that the wind was
The
going to be
wind, sideways
pushing
wind.
the rain directly into my face.
We also didn't factor in that, his parents have tickets in the East End zone. So, like, in any elements, he's going to be hit by them. But it's such a beautiful environment. Honestly, you want to talk about communities? I was thinking of that also when you were there. Just how good we have it in the East End zone. Like when you have good people around you that you really like to be around, we're able to stand up, we're able to get a ticket anywhere in the building and have them there with us. It's a special community in the East End zone. And this week it had Mateo.
But then it
But
dried out in the second half.
we went into the corridor. It was the most packed I have ever
I,
seen.
you, you sent me directions, which A, I did not receive those directions until well after the game, given the quality of the signal at Husky Stadium. But B, I looked up there and I was like, nope, I want no part of this.
Literally, you could not walk. It took like 10 minutes to walk, like maybe 30 feet or something, because everybody was crammed in there. We finally made it through that, dried off a little bit, weather got good, and then all of a sudden, he's dancing to Sandstorm.
And the Huskies are leading in the fourth quarter and pulling off a couple of incredible defensive stops to win this one. First, stopping USC at the 1 yard line on four consecutive plays, and then even causing USC to lose 3 yards on Kamori House's tackle on fourth down, giving the offense a little more breathing room as they came back out on the field. The offense did its job, other than remembering how many players, knowing how many players to have on the field on a crucial third and one.
It is so funny, all of the narratives, and actually thinking back on this, because I was just like, we're gonna lose this game because that penalty.
Oh yeah, it was Chekhov's. I mean, we did on Sunday see Chekhov's missed extra point once again, but it was Chekhov's too many men penalty.
I argue Chris kept bringing up the extra point on. It was funny, they scored the touchdown. We didn't even see that he missed the extra point. Nobody around us did. Maybe they kicked it fast or we were just celebrating too much. But like everybody around us was just like, wait, what? He missed the extra point. The whole run of the game would have gone differently had he hit it.
It
It's
is
not
true.
like, so I'm just like, I don't, you can't just add a point to the score and be like, and they would have won. Because the Rams would have acted differently had he hit the extra point. So I don't really buy that. But the narratives that people have, everything, and again, a thing that we're dealing with this week. People craft narratives based upon outcomes. And the narrative about this Husky football team, undisciplined. I did not hear people talking about that after this game. That was an undisciplined thing to do, to have that 12 men on the field penalty on that third and one that could have iced the game.
I mean, Jed Fish took the blame for it afterwards, said there was a miscommunication, that they said two different packages, basically.
He thought they could have 12 for one play.
Like, come
There
on.
was a miscommunication.
It's the least
The
we can
ref
do.
looked at him and held up a one and a two, and he was like, all right. Was a miscommunication.
Mean, there was a situation the Pistons got a technical foul early, maybe in their season opener, for having six players on the court, and JB Bickerstaff blamed it on the referees for like not making clear which players were allowed in and which weren't. So it can happen, I suppose.
But that play, I mean, before they won the game, it was the play that lost them the game.
Yeah. I mean,
And
they
it's
had a
one of those things.
situation to really do an impressive job offensively of running out the clock after taking over with, I think, about 5 minutes left. Had they picked up that first down, game over, because it was after the 2 minute timeout. So.
As it was within the narrative, the outcome changed, that play is lost, and it gave the UW defense a chance to make some more excellent plays. Obviously, USC drove the ball down the field, but standing tall on a drive just outside of the 10.
I think their win probability got up. USC's got win probability got up as high as about 70%, I think, on that
Oh,
final drive.
in my head, it was 100%.
Agreed. Yeah, but a really impressive series of stops there. And the Huskies stay perfect at home this season. They still have not lost at home since the 2021
Let's say
Apple
on
Cup.
Montlake. I the at home, I mean, like they were in Seattle
But they're
against
not at
Wazoo.
home. I mean, I
Yeah.
agree that they're in Seattle. Saying that they're winless on the road is wrong,
Yeah.
but they are perfect at home. And also, crucially, dramatically improved their chances of getting to 500 and getting to a bowl game.
Yeah,
Which.
it was a massive victory. I think playing in a bowl game, you know, the bowl game or not, it's still fun to see this team play more. The extra practices that they would have because that, I think, is pretty huge. And honestly, for Jed Fish, making a bowl game in this season is a pretty good outcome overall if it happens.
I mean, it's interesting because like USC is now, because of this loss, in the position that UW would be otherwise, where you just lost a bunch of close games and therefore people, think the team is much worse. Like, the LA media is very upset at Lincoln Riley for repeatedly saying like the team is playing pretty well and we just haven't gotten the results to show for it. But statistically, he's right. I thought USC's decision to come out pass heavy in this game against a UW defense that has been much better against that has been incredible against the pass and very mediocre against the run was completely inexplicable. They threw 29 passes and had 9 runs in the first half of this game. And weirdly, once they started running the ball in the second half, they started moving it at will. But I'll take it.
I mean, do you know how many times Miller Moss passed in this game?
It was over 50, wasn't it?
It was exactly 50. 50 passes. It was kind of shocking. I mean, Woody Marks had 22 carries, so it's not like it was a minuscule amount, but they were just so much better running the ball than passing the ball. Obviously, the three picks, two real picks, one was a Hail Mary. But the two picks were, crucial as part of that. But I mean, Woody Marks was kind of running all over this team. And I believe was benched after this game, right?
Yes.
I'm not surprised by that decision. Honestly, a couple of thoughts about USC in general, which first off, it kind of becoming an actual real. Do we play USC every year? Are they're not guaranteed, right?
They are
Only
not a
Oregon is guaranteed.
protected rival, but they are a priority, I would say. I think they play,
I mean,
I think we
I can
got,
look at the
it's at least 2 times in the 4 years that we have future schedules for, but it might be three.
And then as they add more teams, all that will change. But UWSC definitely becoming, we do not play them in 2025.
I would say
It's becoming a bigger
resuming.
rivalry than it has been.
I mean, that was a debate in the Discord. They do play in 2026, and then again in 2027. So it is 3 times out of the 5 years for which we had schedules. I mean, like USC has always meant something in West Coast football, even in times where the program is down. And UW for a long period of time was probably the second best program in the Pac-10 after USC. So inevitably, I think those have been meaningful matchups. I do consider it a, it's obviously probably below. It's certainly below Oregon and Washington State. You can debate USC versus Oregon State. Like Oregon State has the Northwest proximity, but
But I mean,
it's not a
Oregon
very
State's
even
gone. The door's
matchup.
closed on that as a rivalry.
Yes, but I'm saying within the Pac-12 in the historical context, you could debate those two. And then USC probably became less of a rival the last decade because when in the Pac-12 era, the Huskies played them less frequently than when it was the Pac-10.
Kind
They're
of
actually
funny
playing
that
them more
play them
now.
more in the Big Ten.
Yeah.
But I think the rivalry partially, you look at Steve Sarkisian and then also athletic director going to USC, just the gravity of USC to UW and on West Coast football and sports has been something that, we've gone back and forth. I think the decision to Miller Moss played well in their bowl game, played very well in their bowl game. And the decision by Lincoln Riley to stick with Miller Moss and not go into the transfer portal and find a quarterback, they obviously could have. They let
Yeah.
Malachi Nelson go, who ended up not being a starter at Boise State, but was a very highly recruited quarterback. They didn't turn to the younger quarterback. They didn't go into the portal and get a quarterback. They stuck with Miller Moss. That decision, I think, has more or less been proven to be the wrong decision pretty consistently among programs. You look at Oklahoma, who did a similar thing this season. That has not been the right decision generally. And Miller Moss, seeing him in that, he's just not very good, or the UW defense played well, but I know it was raining. Miller Moss was not accurate in this game. He made some throws. It's not like he can't make any throws, but in general, when Miller Moss was dropping back to pass, I was way less scared than I was when they were running the ball.
100%. Yeah, I mean, it was a combination of both. The UW pass defense has been outstanding over the course of the season, but clearly Lincoln Riley weighed in. It's Jaden Maiava, who's a transfer from UNLV, who will be starting this weekend.
The other pieces though, it's funny seeing people talk about Lincoln Riley and basically like looking at Lincoln, his record in the same amount of games, it's way worse than Clay Helton's, which is funny because Clay Helton was generally considered not a laughing stock, but never necessarily respected as a head coach at USC. And
Unfairly maligned, I would say. I mean, I just think I don't think it's a good job. I think the expectations are unrealistic for it.
it's maybe a little bit like Notre Dame, but Notre Dame just has better rosters than
But
USC
Notre Dame
has.
doesn't have the same kind of schedule that USC does.
I don't know if that's exactly true. They've maybe been down at various times. Notre Dame still schedules pretty hard. But And like I like Florida State, you wouldn't have looked at that one this year and been like, that's not going to be a good game, you know? But the other piece is, if you give me
Notre Dame's schedule thus far ranks 74th in the country.
Okay, fair enough. But like, who's on there that ended up being worse than you would expect?
Sure. Last year they were 44th. Year before that they were 33rd. This is a
Okay,
very
I
mid
don't,
schedule.
maybe they don't, but the other piece is, if today you were like starting at the end of the season, this might be a crazy take. If you were like, Lincoln Riley is the coach of UW, you just trade Jed Fish, Lincoln Riley. I'm probably taking Lincoln Riley. And it's funny how maligned he is, and that Jed Fish was the number two biggest coach to move in the coaching transfer portal last year, right? Maybe Mike Elko. There were others, but he was certainly up there
Yeah.
of most successful coaches. And again, I might be wrong in this perspective, but and Lincoln Riley hasn't necessarily proven on the field. I still think Lincoln Riley can coach. He's still a scary person to me on the other side of the field. And it's kind of fascinating how things have worked out. And like you said, like statistically, they've been a much better team than they are. They haven't finished. They don't have the experienced quarterback that they probably should have. But it's fascinating to see where USC goes from here. Are
Yeah, I
they
mean,
definitely going to be bowl eligible?
no, they're 4-5. They need to win two of their final three. Now,
That's why I pulled that up, was to see who they play.
yeah, they have Nebraska, UCLA, and
Also
Notre Dame.
UCLA. They have to go
So
2-3.
2-1.
2-1, or is it
Yeah.
2-3? They have to go 2-1 in that time period.
So
Not
very similar
guaranteed.
position to UW.
They'll be favored in two of the games, but you know, we'll have a conversation about UCLA next week. And then also, you know, the how Maiava does as the backup is going to be a big question mark. But I don't know. I was just kind of fascinated about where USC is after this, but just some brutal, brutal losses along the way. They should have lost to us.
I am fascinated by it too. UW outgained for the first time this season, and now 1-0 in games where they're outgained,
Kind of
four and
incredible
four
that
in
they
games
weren't
where they.
outgamed in either the Indiana or the Iowa games, which were not close.
I mean, the Indiana, as we talked about, it was like basically because of kneel downs, it was that close. But yeah, I mean, if you're going to write a case study in the importance of turnovers to football games relative to success on a per play basis, and special teams, you're going to start with the 2024 Huskies. Turnover, speaking of turnover margin, they're plus six at home, zero in all other games. So
They don't
not
have any turnovers, or they're even.
they're even.
Okay. Fascinating to look at Iowa too. You know, they beat UW 40-16, and it was a pretty embarrassing loss at the time. Losing to Michigan State isn't great, but dropping 40 in 3 of the last 4 weeks for Iowa to have done, and then the game that they lost, they scored, I guess they scored 20 in that game. But it's kind of incredible how many points Iowa has been scoring lately for that program. And I think that loss, you know, to me, Wisconsin, it's a very down year for Wisconsin overall, but it's never going to be an easy game, Wisconsin.
We fixed Iowa's offense. You're welcome. Well, now the Huskies face number six Penn State, coming off a loss at home to Ohio State. 13.5 point favorites in this one. Penn State has played just two ranked teams all season. I was surprised by this. They beat Illinois 21-7 before losing that game to the Buckeyes. And then this is notable. Over the last three seasons, Penn State 27-1 against everyone else, 0-5 against Michigan and Ohio State. The lone loss coming to Ole Miss in last year's Peach Bowl. So you watched part of this game against Ohio State, right? And really noted the offense that Andy Kotelnicki, their new offensive coordinator, was running.
I mean, it's a fascinating offense. Just like casually watching it, and you're like, wait, what's going on? There's an offensive lineman in motion at the goal line, or they have a tight end under center all of a sudden. They use Drew Aller in a bunch of different ways. They had a series where they do sort of like, I guess I'm going to call it the Oregon thing, where the line lines up on, you know, far to one side, and then there's the center and like a quarterback and a running back on the, you know, in the middle of the field. They are willing to mix it up and to run all sorts of different plays at you. Ultimately, I don't know if they're going to need to do stuff like that in this game. You know, it's a playbook that there's just a lot of plays in it, seeing them run against Ohio State. I think that game that I watched was a sort of like pull out everything, you know. Who's Bo Prabula who threw that pass? It was only a 4-yard gain. But you know, their two leading rushers in that game were Tyler Warren, a tight end, basically their Taysom Hill, and then Drew Aller, their quarterback, was the second leading rusher in the game, who only had 10 carries for 31 yards. They did not gain a ton of yards on the ground against Ohio State. But Tyler Warren, you know, again, huge, huge tight end, 3 carries for 47 yards, including a 33-yard run that got them down to the goal line. And then Ohio State had a UW-like goal line stand.
And people were very upset at Colton Nickey that Tyler Warren didn't get the ball, I think, in that situation.
I think he probably should have. Their play calling when they got to the goal line, if it's UW, they're probably scoring a touchdown because their size up front is just going to overwhelm UW's size up front. Against Ohio State, it's a different conversation. And I think commentators like to talk about getting too cute, and I think they might have gotten too. They opened up the playbook a little bit too much at the goal line rather than kind of sticking with what had been working.
I hate the phrase too cute.
I mean, it's conveying a specific
It's
thing.
conveying a specific conservatism that people will never blame. Because if the play doesn't work and it's a conservative play, as I mean, not to jump too far ahead of ourselves, but the Seahawks on 3rd and 4th and 1 in overtime against the Rams, then people blame the execution. And like the execution doesn't even get considered if it's something that is non-orthodox, then it's all on the play call. And your ability to execute the play is part of the value of the play call. And like the offensive line not being able to execute short yardage situations for the Seahawks, not exactly terribly shocking.
I think there's an in-between calling the wrong play in the wrong situation. Jed Fish called the wrong play in the wrong situation when he called the option at the goal line against Wazoo. He called the wrong play. And he had
still
the
don't think
wrong.
he did. It was funny,
Okay.
they ran an option against USC. They ran it to the wide side of the
But
field,
it was
though.
Damon Williams who ran the
That
option,
is
not
also
Will
true. I'm
Rogers.
not disputing that DeMond Williams should have ran it. I just think there's so much hindsight bias. It's all hindsight bias,
I
which
agree.
There's a lot of hindsight bias out there this
We
week.
talked
Let's
about this.
everyone be
I just
careful.
mentioned this like 10 minutes ago about that's the whole world is fucking hindsight bias. It sucks.
Let's just be careful out there.
Let's judge things in the moment, like that storm trade that we all liked when it happened. So I'm not gonna have hindsight bias about Angel Reese being good.
I mean, it's not necessarily hindsight bias.
I question the trade in the moment, to be
You do.
honest.
Colton Nickey had been under Lance Leipold since 2015, followed him from Buffalo to Kansas. Is Penn State the so Tyler Warren, the tight end? People generally compare him more to Travis Kelce, I would say, than Taysom Hill, because he's
It's
actually
diff
good at he's
the
good
way
at
that
being a
they
tight
use
end.
him is like Taysom Hill, though, is what I'm saying in that
Yeah.
situation. Travis Kelce's not lining up under center and running the ball that often.
Every once in a while in short yardage, though. And if they didn't have Patrick Mahomes, they'd probably do it a lot more. He leads the team with 51 catches for 606 yards and 4 touchdowns. All those tops among the receptions and yardage, I believe, tops among Power Four tight ends. But this offense is generally pretty conservative, aside from their sort of creative usage. They have the third highest rush rate in the Big Ten behind Iowa and Michigan. Harrison Wallace III is the only wide receiver who averages even 2 receptions a game for them. So it's really a lot of, when they do pass it, it's a lot of Warren and it's a lot of Nicholas Singleton out of the backfield. When they do pass, though, Drew Aller has taken a huge step forward. His second season as a starter, his completion percentage is up from 60% to 70%, and his yards per completion also up from 11.3 to 13.8, result nearly 3 more yards per attempt. He's also number 3 among Big Ten QBs in rush EPA and ranks 18th nationally in QBR.
ESPN lists Nick Stevens as their starting quarterback. It's very fascinating what's going on here. I think there's an error on the site. But that's the thing. They're a Big Ten team. And that's what UW has kind of come upon. UW does not have a roster designed to beat Big Ten teams. if they are so extraordinarily one-dimensional, then, like Northwestern was, then they're good at it. But
Northwestern, though, it doesn't actually run the ball that much.
well,
They
the
have to
quarterback
pass
runs the
because they're
ball. Or sure,
constantly
yeah, maybe they're
down.
just down by so much.
Yeah.
UW, if they actually want to compete in these games, go on the road in the Big Ten against these kind of blue blood Big Ten teams, they just need to get bigger up front. And it's something that I think is going to be a huge conversation over these next couple of years as the roster is being constructed, keeping the speed on offense that you see from the Pac-12 and that era, and having your offense look more like a Pac-12 team. I think that's what they're not going to turn into a team that's going to run the ball 50 times a game or whatever, or have, their tight end be their leading receiver almost certainly. UW's offense will look the same. Their defense needs to get to a place that they can stop these teams because that's what Ohio State is. That's how you excel and you win games in the Big Ten, is to be able to do both.
And Jed Fish knows this. I mean, he's spoken a
Yeah,
lot
no,
about it. He's...
I'm not saying that they don't. I'm just saying the roster, this is their first year in the Big Ten. They
Yeah.
don't have a Big Ten roster right now, and that is what Penn State is. They do a bunch of things. I almost compare it sort of to like more old school Oregon, where it's funny that people talk about how like Oregon, they spread it out, and it's like the point is running the ball ultimately. It's not a like it is an up-tempo offense, and it's about space, and it's about that the Oregon offense more than Penn State is about being wide and finding places to get your running backs into space. But the point is to run the ball more than it is like a deep passing offense or a quick passing offense. That's what they're looking for. And when Penn State is seeing him coming from the Lance Leipold background, their offensive coordinator, the goal is to find situations to be able to run the ball more effectively against heavier fronts. Because even though Drew Aller is taking a step forward, he's not the type of quarterback who's able to compete against a team like Ohio State. Against UW, I think they're going to be able to run the ball effectively. And I think in situations they have to pass, they're probably going to be able to pass the ball effectively. We saw it against a team like in frustrating ways. We've seen it every road game. It's kind of like all of the previous road games on steroids. And I thought UW played pretty well against Indiana, who's a program that looks a little bit different than the rest of these Big Ten teams. But even looking pretty good against Indiana, they got beaten pretty badly. So,
And against Indiana's backup quarterback.
yeah. What about UW on offense, though? Because that to me is going to be the only place that they have a chance to be in this game.
So they have the Big Ten's best rush defense in terms of EPA per play, only slightly better than average against the pass. They've allowed 100-plus yards on the ground just three times. The Huskies have been over 100 every game this season. USC did run for a season-high 189 in their overtime loss to Penn State that they probably should have won. Ohio State was quite run-heavy last week with 40 carries to just 24 passes, but averaged 7.6 yards per pass and 4.4 yards per rush. So, look, Will Rogers has struggled on the road this season and has played much better at home. They're going to need a really good Will Rogers performance, probably even better than last week against USC, to pull this upset.
And I think the thing that concerns me is looking at, say, this Illinois game that was earlier in the season. Illinois, pretty middle of the road team, probably around the same territory as UW, right? I don't know where they're at standings wise.
I mean, they were ranked. I don't
I
know
mean,
that necessarily means anything. I think they are a better team than UW, though.
I'm not sure if I'm going to buy that they're a better team than UW.
I guess no, their advanced stats are not good. They are 51st in FPI efficiency.
Where is UW in FPI efficiency?
I believe 39th.
Yeah, UW's like they're
41st.
a solid team. They're better than Illinois, but just seeing this game, like Drew Aller was pretty efficient, 15-21, 135 yards, didn't have to do much. Catron Allen ran the ball 18 times for 100 yards. Nick Singleton ran the ball 16 times for 94 yards. They ran the ball 44 times for 239 yards. They stayed on the field. They didn't score a ton of points. Their defense kind of went, I mean, Luke Altmyer having 15 carries for a negative 28 yards is not what you want to see. But Illinois didn't run the ball particularly notably at all. They didn't pass the ball particularly notably at all. And, like Abdul Carter is on the other side of the field, had two sacks in that game. They had seven total sacks, and they kind of terrorized the Illinois offense. And that to me is probably my biggest concern. This is a UW offensive line, which I don't think has been as bad as people expected necessarily. But if they're going to become one-dimensional, those players, seeing those players against Ohio State, I was like, it's not just Abdul Carter. You know, they have speed on the edge. And Abdul Carter is, he looks like Micah Parsons. When you see him, he wears the same number. It would be impossible not to compare him to Micah Parsons. And he's probably unlike any defender UW has seen all season. So I am not sure if they're not going to be able to run the ball effectively, how they're going to contend with that. I'll be fascinated to see what kind of Damon Williams sets they have. And also just how much they kind of open up the playbook and mix it up in this one, because I think they're going to have to, you know, like the play that ended up being the pick six against Indiana, that's the type of play that they should be running ultimately.
But when it doesn't work, it's too cute. Abdul Carter has 6 sacks, 11 and a half tackles for loss this season. Yeah, I mean, I think the recipe, like if there is a path to an upset, it has to involve UW taking the lead early, trying to, you know, force Penn State to pass the ball more than they want to, being able to kind of control the game offensively and have Penn State off balance there. I don't think it's likely, but that's the scenario.
I mean, they're just a better team, and seeing, you know, knowing that Ohio State is a very good offense and seeing that their defense played ultimately pretty well against them. Ohio State had moments where they broke through, but you know, they only gave up 20 points total. A lot of them were field goals, a couple of touchdowns, a couple of field goals. If they're able to run the ball against UW, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult. Kobe King was the other player that stood out to me, a linebacker. He only has 2 sacks on the season, but very, very fast. You know, like the speed that they have on the edge is, again, unparalleled to not necessarily anybody in the country, but to anybody that UW has seen so far. You know, if Iowa's defense played pretty well against UW, if Indiana's defense looked pretty good to UW, I think that Penn State's is going to be at a completely different level.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing we should say here is, you know, as much focus as there we've had on the Penn State offense, they are better efficiency-wise on defense, where they rank 10th in the country, 16th in offense. They are notably poor, 125th in special teams. So
yeah,
perhaps the Huskies can, they had some ups on special teams on Saturday. They had some continued downs in terms of their kickoff coverage and punt
16th
coverage.
Ranked offense, 10th ranked defense, bad special teams. It's just overall, you know, they're not one of the, like, they're in the playoff right now. I don't know if they're really a contender in the playoffs, but in the playoff, you talk about the special teams, UW's special teams ranks even worse than Penn State's. So
oh yeah,
it's not even a place, and it's on the road, and Penn State just doesn't lose.
Percentage chance of victory?
What's the lowest I've ever done?
I don't know.
I think it's like a 7% chance of victory.
Well, I think it's a little bit better than that. I'll say 10%.
I look forward to watching. I'm fascinated to see that, like, this is it. This is the kind of games we want to play, you know? Outside of Michigan, Ohio State, like, these are the games, and it's freaking white out. It's going to be nighttime, an 8 o'clock start at Penn State. This is why UW is in the Big Ten, for these opportunities to play these games. This is different. You know, this is different than going at Stanford. This is different than going at Arizona State, Oregon State, somebody like that. In the Pac-12, there were really only 2 teams that could even be in the conversation for games like this, with Oregon and USC. And in the Big Ten, there are others, still those 2 teams, plus others. And Penn State is a team that, you know, UW played, obviously it was the Fiesta Bowl that they played them with Saquon,
yes,
where, you know, I think it was an admirable performance, but in the end, that team was just too much. And I think that's probably what's going to happen again. But I'm excited about the opportunity and happy they beat USC, because as long as it's not a massive blowout, UW kind of has, they don't have to win this game. You know, the narrative is not going to shift that much if they don't. They kind of only had something to win here.
I agree with that.
So let me ask you a question. In the hypothetical scenario that UW goes undefeated for the remainder of the season,
it's an hour and a half into the podcast.
Do they make the playoff?
No.
Still, do you think they have no chance at this point?
Yeah.
Even beating a top whatever, Penn
with
State,
five losses?
and number one, Oregon.
I mean, I suppose I don't know. Five losses is a lot, man.
Okay. It's really not anything we have to worry about. I said 7% chance of victory. So,
Well, the playoffs
anyway.
may not be something we have to worry about for the Seattle
Oh,
Seahawks.
I forgot we were talking about the Seahawks still. I was ready to wrap it up.
Yeah. I mean, we could just call it a day here. I don't know. You were there. What were your takeaways from this one? Is the Seahawks lost their fourth consecutive home game, matching their longest home losing streak since 2008.
Not a lot of Rams fans. That's something. Actually, the stadium was pretty electric a couple times during this game.
I mean, there were like great moments in this game.
The period right at the end of the second half, where it's kind of like, okay, this team is good. You know, like they had the couple of drives. They really pushed it at the
Right at
very
the
end
end
of
of
the
the first
half.
half, yeah.
Yeah, at the end of the first half, getting the ball back, coming and scoring the touchdown in the fourth quarter. There were some pretty exciting, I think probably the most exciting moments that we've seen at home all year, especially coming off of that Bills game. And I literally earlier in the week was saying that Ohio State receivers, when they get to the NFL, are pretty mid. That is a quote that I uttered the day before this. And I used Jaxon Smith-Njigba as one of the examples of that. And I was like, he has to start stepping up right now, and he didn't. And we finally had the Jaxon Smith-Njigba game.
It was great. It was everything I dreamed of.
I hope this isn't a CJ Procise type situation. Getting the ball downfield for the Seahawks was pretty exciting. The amount of offsides penalties that happened in this game, the way that they threw the ball deep and Geno threw the ball deep, I understand like there were some mishaps from Geno during the game. I think people are a little bit too down on him overall because he was able to get the ball to JSN in a lot of very good positions, and he put the team in the position to win more or less.
I mean, Gino was very down on Gino. He took the blame post game, and understandably, like the decisions he made, particularly the pick six, that was the one that was intercepted. That was the pick six, was him rolling to his left and throwing back into traffic on first and goal, is Ben Baldwin, third Baldwin brother, Ben Baldwin pointed out on Twitter. Like, that's one of the worst decisions you'll ever see. But that's one decision out of, 30, 40 dropbacks. And Gino was under pressure all night long. And I mean, the one thing that I think, the thing more even than this loss that has changed my perspective on what's possible for the Seahawks this season is the fact that we still don't know whether Abe Lucas is going to be back after the bye week. George Fant coming back from injury, immediately being injured again, was a tough situation to go through. Like, I think there is maybe a version of this offense that is a top 10 offense that includes DK Metcalf healthy and the offensive line healthy. And it just is no longer clear that we're going to get to that point this season. So that has changed my perspective. The offense, by the way, now trailing the ongoing season-long DVOA battle to the defense. They are 17th. The defense is 15th.
I thought the defense played a very good game
The
in
defense was
this one.
outstanding. Yeah.
For the most part. Obviously, the drive in overtime didn't look great by the defense, but for the most part, they stood tall when they had to. The interception that Geno threw at the goal line, the second goal line interception, the third total interception from Geno.
The defensive holding that,
Should that have been a hold?
oh yeah, AJ Barner got held. And what he needed to do was do he needs to watch Tyler Lockett tape. Tyler Lockett would have flailed the arms
It
about. He would
was.
have looked like he could not possibly move whatsoever. He would have sold it, and he would have gotten, and it would have been defensive pass interference.
It was pretty obviously a hold in the moment. Like watching the play, I think it was happening right in front of me. Watching the play, it was like, oh, that's going to get called. You know, like that doesn't, it just didn't look right. And then Gino throws the ball and it gets picked. But I get that one. I don't know if excusable or whatever, but like, it was just a hold. That's what the situation, you know, like if there's an un the Rams have benefited in back-to-back wins from some penalties that were pretty questionable.
Some non-penalties that were
Or
pretty
some
questionable.
non-calls that were pretty questionable. And that one really hurt the Seahawks. The Seahawks just kept getting there, though. They kept getting to that point, and the offense kept moving the ball. And then obviously getting the touchdown at the end of the game, the stop that the defense had to send the game to overtime, getting the ball back, driving downfield. And I really was in that position, and I actually thought the Seahawks should have kicked.
Oh, undoubtedly they should have kicked. Oh, you're saying, oh, in the fourth and one?
Yes. And I was feeling conservative. Ultimately, are many things you worry about in the moment, and they end up not mattering. You know what I mean? But you might spend a lot of time just worrying and thinking about something for months, and then in the end, it might not fucking matter. But that moment, I think every decision the Seahawks made at the end of the game and in fourth quarter or in overtime were the right decisions to make overall. I think going for it was the right decision. And the way that the Rams came down and scored a touchdown after kind of proved that. You try to win the
Exactly.
game, and their chances of picking up the fourth down were ultimately pretty high. Their chances of winning the game or scoring a touchdown if they pick up that first down are pretty high. I really kind of thought that they should kick the ball, but seeing just how comfortably, because you do have the Rams coming back with four downs the entire way down the field, right? And they were going to get at least a field goal no matter what, and they probably were going to still score that touchdown. So I think that they made the right decision. I think they made the right decision not to go for two. I thought about that, them going for two. I think if they go for two, the Rams come down and hit a field goal and win. It's one of those things that, like, you can't exactly quantify why, but being down, I think the Rams hit a field goal and win the game
Of course,
on
you
that
can
last drive.
quantify it. They got to a fourth and one, two around midfield, like,
Yeah, I guess they
and then
just go for
punted.
it. Yeah, they
And
just go for it and then.
I mean, Brian Burke from my colleague at ESPN in the analytics department said his rule of thumb is 20 seconds
To go
to
for two.
go for two. And when did the Seahawks score in that situation? There
51
was,
seconds.
I mean, there was enough for them to have another, to potentially have another drive. Yeah, 51 seconds is just way too much time. So no, I don't think that was a serious
It
consideration.
was a recipe to lose the game in regulation, honestly.
And fourth down, as you said, look, they it was the right decision. It's a bummer that the offensive line is such that they just can't pick up 1 yard in that situation, but that's where we are, where we've been for a long time. So,
I can't exactly think of what would have worked, but there was a touchdown that was it Rasheed Williams who scored it? Or who scored
Keith
the touchdown?
Reynolds was the
Keith Reynolds
reverse
scored
touchdown for the Huskies.
on an end around, not a reverse.
Yes, you're right.
But maybe a sneak should be in the playbook. They've run it with Geno and it's
It was,
worked. It's been
I think it was
effective.
just a little too long for a sneak.
I don't feel good about they ran to the left side, right? It was over Okung.
Yes. I mean, what
And
ultimately happened if you re
it
what?
was over. That was when you get older, when you're as old as I am, you say it's over Russell Okung.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, the issue there was not Charles Cross on that play. It was that AJ Barner got blown up by his defender, and that's what sort of push things at the point of attack. It like rewatching it in super slow motion, it was like, well, maybe if Ken Walker had cut back to the right, there was a little bit of a hole to get the 1 yard. But that's one of those things it's easy for me to say when I've slowed it down and paused it entirely, not for him when he's running at full speed.
There are many. I think they could have run a different play there. I think they probably should have run a different play there, but that play might have also not worked.
Yeah.
That nothing is a guarantee on fourth and one. USC saw that the day before, right? USC ran from the goal line multiple plays and didn't score on any of them against a worse defense than the Seahawks were facing. Nothing is for certain. Nothing is forever, and they just didn't get the yard, and the Rams won. I don't know. That's kind of it. I don't feel like I don't feel like we need to take that much from this game as far as the quality of these teams. I think the defense played well, and that's the most important piece. The offense can play well. Geno's not going to throw three picks in these games, and Jaxon Smith-Njigba, I actually feel better about the Seahawks overall as a team after this game. I still think they have a chance of making the playoffs, but a loss in the NFC West, their NFC record's looking pretty brutal right now. A loss in the NFC West to a team that's right neck and neck with them. There's just still a lot of football left to be played, though. And once DK is back post bye week, if there's a chance that Abe Lucas is back post bye week, that could be
Not a
huge.
guarantee that DK will be back, which is
I
kind of
feel like
shocking.
I think he probably will be. But even then, just knowing what JSN can do, it's pretty exciting to see. And this was it was what we've been wanting for 2 years is to have this JSN game. And Devin Witherspoon making plays, getting in the backfield, blowing stuff up. It was like all of a sudden Mike McDonald kind of unleashed the defense a little bit. I felt like they'd been very restrained for a while. And this was the game where it was like he got more blitzing involved in different situations. And getting Witherspoon in the backfield was huge.
Yeah, well, I think it was Devin Witherspoon's probably best game of the season, without having looked at like PFF grade or that sort of thing. But you noticed him in a way that you haven't most of the year. The DVOA playoff odds at FTNFantasy.com down to 10%, given, being last place in the NFC West and those tiebreaker issues that you mentioned with the 1-4 conference record. That's
And
probably not
they're very
happening.
likely to be 4-6, after they come back from the bye week, obviously going at San Francisco. It's a winnable game, it's a losable game. Could they rattle off a bunch of wins in a row? Absolutely. There's nobody left on the schedule that the Seahawks can't beat. The hardest game they have to me is still at Niners next week, or the week after the bye. After that, every single one of those games is winnable. The Packers at home is winnable, the Vikings at home is winnable, the Cardinals at home and on the road are winnable. At the Jets is winnable. At the Bears is like, if they could put a little something together, maybe this is too wishful thinking, hopium, as they say. If it's just a red wave that happened at the beginning, or red mirage, what's it called?
Yes.
At the beginning of the season, and they can put it together in the second half, then all of these games are winnable games.
I don't
But
believe
if
their recent results against the 49ers qualify as a red mirage, but perhaps the Cardinals will.
They,
What you didn't mention, by the way, in
what's
terms of the
that?
long term, Cody White. You're nodding is not great podcasting. I'm going to be honest with you.
And another player who I had to be like, who's this again? 2 weeks in a row. Like the Seahawks are digging deep. I don't want to say complain about injuries, but the team has been, they've been injured outside of quarterback at very unfortunate positions.
Yeah, without question.
I'll say every team has injuries. The Seahawks aren't more injured than probably anybody else, but losing DK for a couple of games, they're getting deep into it. It's one of those things where you're
I
like,
mean, you can
man,
even point to
a lot of
defensive
Jake
end,
Bobo. Yeah.
rusher, pass rusher, edge, and then cornerback on defense are the most important positions, and that's where they've had the injuries there. So, yeah. I mean,
They've lost a lot of high leverage games, I guess I'll say, or games from high leverage players.
yeah.
And it, we'll see about Abe Lucas, but whether he's actually a part of the plans long term or can be. This team, if we are, I know that the, because we should start thinking of the draft a hint. There's a lot of football left to be played. If we are in April or May or whenever the draft happens this year, and the Seahawks are not taking an offensive lineman with their first or second pick, they've probably approached the draft wrong. Like, that is the most important piece for this team is, and they didn't last year. I'm not saying they made the wrong pick, they made the right pick with Byron Murphy, but they just need to build up this offensive line to be able to do the things that Ryan Grubb wants to do.
I mean, it's tough because Anthony Bradford was drafted, I mean, he was the third round, right? But which is when, John Schneider's like to take guards, but they've taken guards in back-to-back years, and those just guys just aren't good enough. And I don't know
They
what
may
they
need to
knew.
draft a tackle.
I don't know what they knew about Abe Lucas's knee then. I don't know what they know about Abe Lucas's knee now. I mean, this is one of the things I've been thinking about with Joel Embiid. Like, a lot of people have been calling for more transparency from the Sixers and Joel Embiid about his knee injuries. Like, These are things that are confusing to doctors. So you, a layperson, is not going to hear anything about it that you are going to understand. Like, sometimes this shit is just a mystery, and it's just when you feel right and when you don't. Sometimes it requires, multiple surgeries or a cartilage replacement, as we saw in the case of Lonzo Ball, when he was able to return to the NBA after missing, 2.5 years. Sometimes these things don't work the way that you hope they do, and that sucks for everybody involved, but we'll see.
I just think they need to invest some high-level resources on the offensive line. 2022 draft, pretty solid overall for John. I have to say, give John Schneider a little bit of credit. He made the trade to this is a draft that they had traded away their first round pick. So given that situation that they had traded away the 10th pick in the draft to still end up with Charles Cross, Boye Mafe, Ken Walker, Abe Lucas, Kobe Bryant, Tariq Woolen. Those are their first whatever six picks that they got, six contributors to the roster right now with their first six picks is pretty massive and still ultimately pretty young. But I think they need Abe Lucas insurance over there. And they just need more depth on the line overall.
All right, well, we can worry about the draft for a long time from now. Are you willing to commit to if the Seahawks get a top 10 pick, a live podcast?
Sure.
Okay. There you go. We're on the record. You have been talking about wanting to do some more new PeltonCast merch.
Oh, I think we need to do it right now before a live podcast. Would people want online merch from the PeltonCast?
Maybe they can let us know in the Discord or peltoncast@gmail.com.
Can we say what it is?
You're hoping to do a beanie.
Yeah, like a dark gray. I saw a Poliachi beanie. Don't tell them. A Poliachi beanie that looked like a PeltonCast beanie, and I wanted it. So I think it could be very
And
subtle.
unfortunately, we have no connections to get those whatsoever. No, we do.
I still want it. But we have to make our own.
Why not both?
Before we sign off, just again, thank you to this community and everybody who's here. It's what makes being a part of this world, so rewarding, and having people around us who are supportive and who also I think, you don't have to see eye to eye on how we do, but it's definitely helpful that people have a similar worldview about things and the compassion for all peoples, all sexual preferences, all genders. And that's something that the PeltonCast definitely is one of our most important tenets. And so appreciate the community here and supporting us in that through so many years that we've done this twice.
Yeah, I guess the other thing I'd say that I didn't say at the beginning is, first off, I hope everyone is doing okay in the wake of this, and let's be sure to take care of each other and check on each other and make sure that we're doing okay, or at least okay not being okay for some period of time now. On that note, hope we could provide a pleasant distraction for some period of time. Thanks
I'm
for
sorry we
listening.
didn't fight about anything. Next time.
I guess we didn't even really fight when I came over to your house for mom's birthday dinner earlier.
I was gonna I was I knew you were gonna agree with me about the polls being mostly right, but the podcast is over, by the way.